This is an Alien UFO Podcast Classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. There are a number of UFO episodes that I released on the podcast a few years ago that are full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. In this episode, I'm talking to Paul Wallace about his book, The Scars of Eden. Has humanity confused the idea of God with memories of ET contact? Paul is a speaker, researcher, and author. As a senior churchman, he served as an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia and in-service training for pastors. Hi, Paul. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
G'day, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
So I wanted to talk to you about your book. It's called The Scars of Eden. Has humanity confused the idea of God with memories of ET contact? And it's an amazing question, particularly from you, I feel, because you are an archdeacon.
Well, yes, 33 years in church-based ministry, and for some of that time, archdeacon of the Anglican Church here in Canberra, in Australia, and a theological educator and a church doctor. And so it does surprise people sometimes when I say, well, that's my background, that's been my career, and now I'm writing about aliens or paleo contact, the theory that our ancestors had ET contact in the deep past. But it really flows from that, because I got into that field through the work of Bible translation, which was a big part of my work for many years.
So you say you've been in the job, so to speak, for so many years, and you say, like others that work in the Christian ministry, you've had your fair share of paranormal experiences. So could you tell us one or two of those?
Sure. Well, ministry is stretching in all kinds of ways. And one of those is that through the years, you will be exposed to paranormal situations that people are experiencing in their lives or in their homes. And they'll come to you, the parish priest, to say, can you fix this for me? And most of us are on a pretty steep learning curve as we respond to those situations, because, funnily enough, it isn't something that's really covered in practical detail in your training at theological college. We all have to learn these things on the hoof. So immediately we're delving into dusty old books to find out how our spiritual ancestors handled these things. And so I talk about my own experience as a church doctor, for instance. Sometimes you'll get called into a situation where there are layers of problems, and there might be governance problems, pastoral problems, personality problems, situational problems. But very often, if you're in a church that's had problems over decades that keep recurring with all the human players changing, it means there's another layer to the story, and that layer might be what some would call an archonic or a demonic problem. And then you have to respond to that. You do get people coming with other experiences of hauntings in their homes. Again, ghosts, it's not something that gets covered at theological college, but you do have to help people respond to that. And so it stretches your own worldview and your own theology as you encounter these things and begin responding to them. And like many believers, I started off my faith journey with a fairly simple worldview that had room for God, the devil, angels, demons, animal, vegetable, mineral, human. And those were the only boxes I could tick to understand the world around me. But after only a few years in the ministry, you realize life's a bit more complicated than that. And there's a bit more diversity to the company we're keeping in the cosmos than that suggests. And so part of my own journey has been learning to stretch my worldview, revisit it when it doesn't fit the facts, and expand my awareness of what's actually going on around us. So for me, it's not been a question of degree, I suppose. How much are you willing to go back and rethink? How many presuppositions are you willing to question in order to understand phenomena? And being able to ask those questions has led me into the field of paleo contact today.
If somebody came to you and said they've got a spirit in the house or something like that, or ghosts,
did you kind of, your first thought is, okay, these people don't really have spirits and ghosts, but I'll play along and I'll go and see what's happening?
Well, yes. Yes, I can think of one situation where a young lady, she was living alone with her son, came and said, oh, I think I've got a haunting in my home. And from the get-go, I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure if you do. It was just a gut feeling that something else might be going on. But I did go to her home with another member of staff for safety, so to speak. And the way we read it, actually, no, there wasn't a haunting. It was just that she herself was a bit troubled and had some issues. You always have to filter. I mean, all of us go through life asking questions about what's real and what isn't, but you certainly have to do that in pastoral ministry as people bring their experiences to you. And there are those that have other explanations, other things are going on, and then there are other situations that it's quite clear something paranormal is at play.
You have trained pastors in the principles of interpreting ancient texts, and the Bible in particular. And this must be a real strength to have, particularly with what you've done with this book and your other books and all this investigation you've been doing.
Well, that's right. Escaping from Eden and the Scars of Eden and the new book this year is Echoes of Eden really are all built on the skills I built up in hermeneutics, the principles of interpreting ancient texts. And this was something I taught to pastors in service training for 15 years. And some of the tools that you use in that area are we call form criticism. And that is where whatever text you're looking at, you have to ask, what kind of text is this? What kind of literature is it? Is it poetry? Is it prose? Is it fiction? Is it fable? Is it a moral tale? Is it history with interpretation? And you have to find the evidence within the text itself and then within the context to answer that question, because that immediately defines what you're going to do with it. Source criticism asks, where did this text come from? What was the original form? How does this differ from the original form? Because that then gives you the author's intent, and that guides you in what to do with it. And then always I would teach pastors to ask the basic linguistic question, what do the words mean? And it's funny how often people can read a familiar verse of scripture and come to an interpretation without stopping to ask what the individual words mean, which can, of course, flip the entire meaning of a text. Now, these are tools that, in theory, every preacher should be using from week to week as they teach from the scriptures. And it was really those bread and butter tools that led me into the world of paleocontact through drilling down into moral and translation anomalies in the Bible. Little bits that, oh, that doesn't quite make sense, or well, why does God do that? That doesn't make sense. And when I approached those as translation questions, it led me to some really key words on which the whole interpretation of those stories pivots. Are they stories of God, or are they stories of something else? And so one of the key words I came to was the word Elohim, which is the oldest word in the Bible. It gets translated as God. But there are little clues in the text that give away the fact that this word has a more interesting story than that. First of all, it's a plural form word. It's a masculine plural. It takes plural verb forms and attributives. Then it exhibits plural behaviors. And then it has arguments with itself. And then it goes to war with itself. So these are all clues that you're actually looking at a community of beings. That's why it's a plural. And that was the little white rabbit that led me into some questions that took me into the whole area of ET contact and allowed me to see that the Elohim stories are the recollections of humanity's contact with a diversity of powerful beings in the deep past, which have been translated as God's stories, but are really something else. So in my book, Escaping from Eden, what I do is I ask the question, what happens if we read the Elohim stories but use the etymological meaning of that word, the root meaning, because the root meaning of Elohim is the powerful ones. It gets translated as God, demons, angels, false gods, landlords. And as I read different Bible translations, I thought, well, how are they getting to that? And how are they making the call as to which it means? Let's reread the stories with the root meaning, the powerful ones, and see what happens to the stories. And to my astonishment, the stories changed in a way that was not random. Obviously, it would change the stories. But what happens when you read the Elohim stories, the stories of the powerful ones, is suddenly you're reading the summary form of the Sumerian, Babylonian, Arcadian, and Assyrian stories. And it becomes clear very quickly, those are the source stories. And the source stories are not stories about God. They're stories about entities that the Mesopotamians referred to as sky people, or some would know the name Anunnaki. And the sky people are not human. They're not God. They are visitors from elsewhere in the cosmos here to colonize planet Earth and govern over it. And that's the shape the stories suddenly take in the Bible when you do this translation work.
And is there a story that stands out for you that would be a good illustration of this?
Well, there's quite a dramatic illustration of how different words for God are there for a reason in the text. So if you go to the story of Abraham and Isaac, some people might know this story where Abraham, the progenitor of the Hebrew people, he's been promised a son, even though he and his wife both past childbearing age. They have this close encounter with three sky people, and then his wife becomes pregnant, and they have their son Isaac. And then the Elohim tell him he has to kill that son, which is a bizarre thing, until you realize that all around the world, if you look at religious history, there seems to be this dark period where people would sacrifice children to their gods. And if you think about it, if you can persuade a human being to kill their child, it means you've got total control over that human being. There's nothing that human being wouldn't do for you if it will do that. And if you can get that human being to kill their first child, well, that's absolute control. And that seems to have been part of the religious mentality of ancient cultures around the world in the deep past. And now Abraham seems to have got sucked into it. These Elohim, these powerful ones, whoever they were, have so terrorized him that he's about to kill his son. And then a messenger of Yahweh turns up and says, don't do it. Now, in the text, you've got Elohim saying, give us your son. And then you've got Yahweh coming in and saying, don't do it, Abraham. Give him something else. The way that's translated at the moment, it's translated as a God story where God says, kill your son. And then at the last minute, he says, only joking. And anyone who reads that story is shocked and appalled. And how do you interpret that story? It's not a moral story. What moral of the story can you get from that? Well, preachers do try and get a moral from that story, but the only one you can get from it is don't question God, even if he asks you to kill your children. Well, who's going to preach that? If some member of my church comes to me in the morning and says, oh, I nearly killed my son this morning, changed my mind at the last minute. And if I say, why? Well, I was going to do it because I thought God wanted me to. And I changed my mind at the last minute because God said not to. I wouldn't turn to him and say, well, you're a man of great faith, aren't you? I'd be calling child protection services. And yet people, believers, preachers go to that text about Abraham and they say, oh, what a great man of faith. Instead of saying there's something very wrong with this story. It's wrong if it's a God story where he can tell you to do something atrocious and then change his mind. It makes a little more sense when you realize you've got a human being caught in the crossfire between Elohim and Yahweh, who are battling for control or possession of this human being and his lineage. So that's one of those stories that even, you know, a parent reading a child's Bible to a child, if it covers that story, they're going to be left scratching their head thinking something's off in this story. That doesn't make sense at all. Or if you go to Genesis 3, which is famously called the story of the fall, the way it's translated at the moment as a God story, God in the story wants the human being so unintelligent they don't even know they're naked. He wants the humans kept at an animal level. And it's the serpent, apparently. He wants the humans to have a better human experience. And then the God character imposes the death penalty for eating a piece of fruit that he said, oh, don't touch that tree. And again, a child will say, well, couldn't God see what was going to happen? How can it be the death penalty for eating a piece of fruit? Get to Genesis 6. How can a God of love suddenly genocide the human race? Children spot these anomalies. And in reality, they are translation problems where we have taken a story of colonization, of anti-human behavior by non-human entities governing our ancestors. And if you'd read it that way, well, there are ugly stories within human behavior, but you've suddenly got a big problem if you say it's a God story, where God is doing something stupid or failing to anticipate something a child could anticipate, or doing the morally worst thing we can imagine, which is genocide. And in my books, I argue that we will actually save the psychology of our species a heap of trouble if we can peel back the layers of wrong translation and say, no, God is not like that. And those are not God's stories. Those are our ancestors' memories of being colonized by extraterrestrial visitors. That's why they're full of violence and anti-human behavior. And the things we blamed God for in the past, we shouldn't have done that. And it resolves a heap of problems once you get into the root meanings and ask what's really going on in those texts.
It says in the book, there are ancient narratives from around the world that kind of say the powerful ones flew here in a craft which hovered over the floodwaters and began terraforming a devastated planet. And you found these kind of narratives with the Aboriginals and with people in America, and it's like it's being repeated from thousands of years ago, or the same story being told by people who could never have talked to each other.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are cultures that did not have contact with each other. They're on different continents. They're in different periods of history. And what's interesting is that it's clear that it isn't that a piece of literature has gone around the world and then been retold by the local culture. And it's not an oral tradition that's gone around the world as Chinese whispers and repeats for that reason. There are clues in these repetitions that what we're looking at is a visual memory that is shared, that different cultures have then told using different language and metaphor. So in Genesis, you've got the Ruach that turns up and hovers over the waters before it starts terraforming the planet. Now, Ruach is generally translated as spirit. People think it must be the spirit of God, therefore. But the word means a thing that creates a wind or a blast of wind. What is that, we wonder? Well, when we go to the source texts and we look at the terraforming of planet Earth and the Mesopotamian stories, we're just told about winds again. And in fact, there are four winds in that story that come in and clear flood waters and dry land and separate fresh water from salt water, all the basic rehabilitation you'd need to do on a devastated and flooded planet. Both those stories begin on a planet that already exists, so they're not creation stories, but the planet's flooded and shrouded in darkness as if it had been hit by some kind of cataclysm. And the phrase in the Hebrew is tohu wa bohu, which means that it's been laid waste and devastated. If you go to the Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan version of the story from out of Guatemala, it talks about these entities arriving in the sky and hovering in the sky and having discussions about how to terraform and how to reestablish life on Earth and how to develop sentient life on planet Earth. If you go to the Philippines, they talk about a hawk hovering over the waters, the flood waters, and then using its wings to create vortices of wind to clear the high land and dry the land so that there are now safe spaces for the survivors to live on and where they can begin developing life further. If you go to Nigeria, Nigeria, I think Cameroon have this story as well, the story of Osunubuwa, the Almighty One above the waters, who descends from the sky on a chain and then begins clearing the flood waters and developing the land. So you've got different images. You've got the hawk, you've got the ruach, and in the Hebrew uses a very interesting word that says it hovered like a hawk. So that's kind of curious. That's clearly how you'd understand hovering if you've never seen technology before. It's doing what a hawk does. Then you've got the winds, you've got the chain, different languages, different metaphor, but the same thing has been seen and is being described. And it's really interesting for me going around the world, finding these different narratives, seeing the connections between them, and realizing there's something visual that's been recalled here, because it gives you different questions to go back to the ancient mythologies with. I mean, if you have an ancient mythology, you might say, well, is that a moral tale? Is it fact? Is it fiction? Is it history? Some people like to read mythology in a fundamentalist way, where every sentence, every word, that's exactly what happened. It's like a scientific account. It's like a diary entry. Others like to say, well, no, this must be some kind of a moral fable. Neither of those really work with the Bible stories. You get a very warped morality if you think they're moral tales. And then fundamentally, you got a very warped image of reality and God if you read it that way. But if you go with another question, what memory is being carried by this narrative? What was seen that has been carried in this language and metaphor? The stories open up in an amazing way, and that's when you begin to see the correlations across the cultures and realizing they are confirming one another's ancient memories.
Can you tell us about, is it Quetzalcoatl? And they say he attempted to engineer a useful slave species.
Yes, that's right. There are a number of related narratives from out of Central and South America. The Toltecs, Olmecs, Aztecs, Mayans, their stories are all interrelated. And we didn't know much about these stories for a long time, because when the Catholic forces of Portugal and Spain went into Central and South America, they deliberately obliterated the literature of those cultures. And Mayan culture was a literary culture. They had vast libraries of literature, which mainly the Spanish incinerated, because they regarded them as being full of nothing but superstition and lies of the devil, to use a quote from one of the bishops who was heading up part of the invasion. And what they incinerated was stories of paleocontact, among other things. We know that now because after 200 years, a copy had survived the incinerations and the burnings and the executions of the priests. They executed the priests because they didn't want anyone who could read the ancient languages. Just in case a copy survived, they didn't want anybody to be able to say what was in it. And so they'd done the burnings and the executions. But 200 years later, the descendants of the priesthood of the feathered serpent, that's Quetzalcoatl, brought a copy of the text to a Dominican friar by the name of Francisco Jimenez, who was a parish priest in Guatemala. And true to his order, he got very close to the people he served and listened to them and learned from them and won their trust to the extent that they said, would you be interested in our story of beginnings? And they give him this text, which he then spends 7 years translating out of a dead language into Spanish. And in the very early 1700s, he publishes it as the people's book, the people's stories, the Popol Vuh, you know it as. And that's how we know what was in those ancient stories that were incinerated. It tells the story of beings referred to as those who engineer. It's a very interesting turn of phrase. You turn up to the devastated planet, terraform it, and then they say to each other, let us make avatars for ourselves to do the work and bring us our food. And that's us. Their project is to design and build Homo sapiens. And clearly they're working with the life that's already here. So whether it's interbreeding, whether it's genetic modification. We're not told in too much detail, other than that it took a long time to get it right, that they produced or engineered animals that were, you know, nice animals, but they weren't clever enough to be useful helpers. And there's a funny little parallel in Genesis there, because there's the story of Adam being shown a bunch of animals that have been produced, but none of them are suitable as a helper. And so they go back to the drawing board, they try again, and then they produce something that's very strong and capable, but has no interest in serving superiors. I mean, if you can imagine engineering something like a gorilla that's quite intelligent, very capable, very strong, it's not going to work for you. It was that level of mistake they were making. And the story is very open. It took a long time to get it right. Finally, they spliced a bit more of their own DNA into the mix, to use our language today, and they came up with a being that was too intelligent. It was us plus better ability to foresee potentialities. That means precognition. It means remote viewing. It means better telepathic connection, better self-healing. And they found that these entities were too smart to want to work for superiors. They couldn't be managed. And so they have an emergency meeting, and they say to their chief genetic engineer, Quetzalcoatl, can you do something to dial these humans down so that we can actually work with them, actually manage them? And what he comes up with is a vapor that, when sprayed over human populations, brain damages them to the point that they lose these higher cognitive abilities, that they are limited now to their five physical senses. Their perceptual field is now only what's immediately around them. And for anything else, they'll have to rely on an authority to tell them what's what. And they found they could work with that. They could manage that. Now, what's curious about that story is that the thumbnail version of it repeats in narratives all around the world. If you go to the stories of the Greek so-called gods, there's the conflict between Zeus and Prometheus, because Prometheus has made the human beings too technologically able. In Genesis, we've got Genesis chapter 11, where we have a species that is a technological species. And in the Scars of Eden and Escaping from Eden, I argue we're looking at a spacefaring civilization that has built a stargate on the Shinar plane. That gets bombed back into oblivion, and the people brain damage to the point where they lose the power of speech. You can go to the Nigerian story of Abasi and Atai, who are beings from off planet who live in an island on the sky and genetically engineer human beings, and then discover they are too able. And so they have to release devices into the environment that would damage the human beings' mental health and physical health, so that they can be managed. And so these themes of engineering human beings that are too clever and then having to dial them down, well, that's in narratives all around the world. And you can see those conflicts play out in the Bible as well. The whole tussle in Genesis 3 is a tussle among Elohim having arguments about how intelligent and conscious the human being should be, how much like one of us the humans should be. That's the phrase in the Hebrew, one of the phrases that clues you that you're looking at plural beings. And it's a story that doesn't glorify anybody, if you think about it. Doesn't glorify human beings, that story. Doesn't glorify the rulers. It's shared and remembered because that's what happened. We have a memory of ancestors who had higher cognitive abilities, and we have a memory of being dialed down and managed and governed over.
It's remarkable how these stories go all around the world. And I'm reminded of a couple of other things in the book. You talk about Aboriginal elders were asked, where do you people come from? And their ancestral source, they say they come from a world orbiting a star somewhere in the Pleiades. And then you also talk about somebody called Blair, who said, my family are Cherokee, and my father taught me that the visitors told us they were from a planet orbiting a star in the Pleiades.
Yes, that's right. The Pleiades do crop up. That region of space is given as the location from which our ancient helpers came. And you rightly say an Aboriginal story, Australian Aboriginal story, a Native American story. When you talk about ET visitations today, you know, often our minds go straight to something like Mars attacks or Independence Day or Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But these peoples have a memory of something that was helpful and benevolent. The Mohawk people have a memory from their deep past in which something had happened to the environment that meant that they had to go up into the hill country to survive. And they're now in country that they're not familiar with the flora and fauna, and their survival really hangs in the balance. And their story is that beings appeared from somewhere else who helped them in that moment to find which plants are good for food, which are good to avoid, which are good for medicines, which are good for higher consciousness. And that story is similar to the stories and beginnings that you'll find among the Cherokee people, as you mentioned, who say that they gained their understanding of how to live as a civilization on planet Earth, learning about agriculture, learning about sanitation, fundamental things about how to live as human beings on the planet. They learned them from visitors. The Pleiades, again, is mentioned. If you go to Mali in West Africa, they will say that their help in the beginning was from people who came from a planet orbiting Sirius C. And they told that story before we knew there was a Sirius C. We didn't even know there was a Sirius B when the Dogon people of Mali told us that story. And the regions of space is curious because there are three regions of space that keep cropping up in ancient ancestral narratives. There's the Pleiades, there's Sirius, the Sirius star system, and there's Orion. There's a curious verse in the book of Job, which many scholars believe is in fact the oldest book in the Bible, even though it doesn't come right at the beginning and it's not a story of origins. As a text, they think it's the oldest text that made its way into the Hebrew canon. And many scholars believe it's actually an Arabic book that somehow found its way there. And in the book of Job, there is a verse that ties these three regions of space together. And it asks the question, and it's a challenge to the main player in the story. It essentially says, can you reverse the power dynamics between Orion and Earth, or Sirius and Earth, or the Pleiades and Earth? Can you take charge of them instead of them taking charge of us? Is essentially what the verse says. Now, many Bible scholars, interpreters will say, well, that must be something to do with the seasons, you know, identifying the seasons by the stars. And it's really saying, can you change the seasons? But that's a little distance from the text itself, which seems to imply there's a power dynamic between those regions of space and planet Earth. And it just happens to have named the three regions that our ancestors say our visitors and ancient governors came from. So that's a little bit of a smoking gun there. Our ancestors said people came from those places and ruled over the planet, sometimes in peaceable collaboration and sometimes in conflict with one another, for hegemony over planet Earth.
Moving up to date, there's still people claiming ET contact with abduction and all sorts of things. And you say in the book that you found this very close to home when somebody called, is it Akua, a 26-year-old woman in Angola, had an experience?
Yes, that's right. I learned this because I was preparing to publish Escaping from Eden, which is the first of the Eden series, where I argue that many of the biblical stories are really stories about ancient ET contact. And I remembered, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to tell my parents-in-law about my new book. Now, my parents-in-law are devout Christians. They're from Ghana. They are a Pentecostal and Baptist background, and I had no idea how they were going to take my book. So I thought, okay, I'll tell them after we've had a nice meal, we've all drunk some nice Australian wine, everyone's relaxed, and I'll just slip it in the conversation. So I did that. And I laid out everything I've just told you, Simon, and they poker faces, giving nothing away. I had no idea how this was going down. And when I finally paused for breath, my father-in-law, Kofi, looked back in his seat and he said, "Paul, a penny has dropped." And what he meant was all those stories that didn't quite make sense, where God's behavior seemed very odd in the Old Testament, suddenly resolved because he could see, oh, those are stories about extraterrestrial species colonizing us, governing us. That makes much better sense. And he was just joining all the dots as I was speaking. And then my mother-in-law, Patience, leant forward and she said, "Paul, we already know this story. Because in Ghana, you go to school, you'll be taught the modern scientific worldview, you'll be taught Christian orthodoxy, but the local knowledge, the local knowledge carries an awareness that we have company on planet Earth. We know about the non-human presence on planet Earth intersecting with human beings, and we're very closely connected with a family who experienced an abduction." And it was from Anloga in the Kita district of the Volta region of Ghana. And it was in 1986. This young lady was taken. She went missing for 3 years. And then she reappeared. She made her way home. And it was a long time before she was willing to tell her parents what had happened. Now, her parents assumed she'd been kidnapped or attacked, killed, sex trafficked. Maybe it was a failed elopement. They were waiting for something like that, a story like that to emerge. Finally, she told her mum, "The reason I couldn't contact you for 3 years is that I was held in an underwater base and I was made to have children. And the people who held me were not human. They were the Mamiwata people." Now, when she said Mamiwata people, her mum knew the Mamiwata stories. I don't know how seriously she took them. It was nothing she ever expected to hear from her own educated daughter. But now she's saying, "That's why I couldn't contact you. This is what happened to me." Her mum understood the story because it's a story that's been told for hundreds, maybe thousands of years in Ghana. So suddenly to discover I was closely connected with that story was amazing. And it sent me on a journey all around the world in which I discovered that that story is repeated by every culture on the planet. Every culture has a story about beings who take human beings and use them for hybridization, take them to underwater bases. They're not allowed to communicate with home. They'll be returned at a later stage, often healthier than they went away. They'll be used for hybridization because our visitors want more of our DNA in their gene pool. And generally, the stories say people are not taken by force. They are enticed by the incredible beauty of these other beings and with promises of health and advancement. It's such an unlikely story. And yet it repeats in every detail, whether you go to the Maharani tradition in Kenya or the Yumoya tradition, Caribbean. You can go to Haiti, Cuba. You'll hear these stories repeat. Go to the Philippines. They have words that exist in their language only to tell these stories. And those words have their roots in India. You can go to Greece and hear the stories there. The whole of Europe is named after an ET abductee, Europa, who had three hybrid children with a non-human entity that kidnapped her, or enticed her, I should say, with amazing beauty. You can go to the Norse countries. You've got the stories of hybridization in the Greek, of course, the stories of the Titans. Go to Wales, and you've got the story of Tylwyth Teg, exactly the same as Akuya's story in Wales from centuries past, and then up into Scotland. And you listen to the fae stories. Well, those stories are not stories of beings like Tinkerbell. You know, if I say the word fae or fairy, that's usually what people imagine. But the stories told by the ancient Scots are of a non-human presence that has strings to pull in the governance of human beings and uses human beings for hybridization. And to my amazement, that story, that account of things was published in 1600 by a Presbyterian minister. Now, Presbyterians are very conservative, reformed, evangelical believers, and yet the Presbyterian minister in Aberfoyle in Scotland listened to the locals in the same way that Francisco Jimenez did in Guatemala, and began to think there is something else going on here that we need to acknowledge. And so he wrote his book, The Secret Commonwealth, which is about exactly this phenomenon. So when I discovered that and realized it really is global, and the details that repeat are so unlikely and yet repeat with such precision, I realized that had to be in the sequel to Escaping from Eden. So The Scars of Eden tells these stories. And when I set out to write The Scars of Eden, it wasn't because I wanted to write about ET abduction, because I know people find that very difficult to take seriously. But as soon as you listen to ancestral narratives with any degree of respect, you cannot avoid stories of ET abduction because they are worldwide.
It almost sounds like even today, Quetzalcoatl's still trying to build the perfect slave race.
Yes, you could certainly see it that way. And many of these stories, you read them and you think, is that about the past or is that about the present? I mean, when Quetzalcoatl develops a vapor to spray over human populations to dumb them down, my mind goes back to the 1970s when we were pumping the fumes of leaded fuel into all our cities, until journalists pointed out that this does in fact brain damage people. And thankfully they won the day, and that's why we're now all driving hybrid cars and using lead-free fuel. And a lot of these stories, I think, were bequeathed to us to get us to ask the right kinds of questions if we want to live healthily and happily on our own planet.
And so can you tell us about Jane Pooley and her missing pregnancies?
Yes, Jane Pooley is a very brave Australian woman who went on television to share her experiences of what she believes are abduction experiences where she was used for hybridization. Now, you can imagine the kind of scorn and ridicule poured upon her for sharing a story like that on national television. But she did. And as part of the program, it was Studio 10 on Channel 9. She's interviewed by Ita Buttrose, who's an absolute pillar of the media in Australia. She was given a respectful interview. Well, certainly, that's the way it was edited. And as part of it, she had to do three polygraph tests. And she passed them all. There was no deceit found in her recollections at all. So at the very least, we can say she sincerely believes this happened. She sincerely believes these are memories of things that have happened. What they didn't include in the program was the medical evidences she showed, papers from her doctors, that showed that she had two pregnancies where the baby disappeared. There was no miscarriage, there was no abortion, there was a pregnancy, and then there was no baby. And Jane says those were the two hybridized children. She has, I think it's three regular children of her own, but she felt that she needed to come and acknowledge this story of having been taken since she was 5 years old. So frequent abductions all through her life, and among those abductions were instances where she was used for hybridization. Now, people reacted, of course, as if they'd never heard such a ridiculous story, never mind that every culture has been carrying stories like this for thousands of years. But people don't share these stories publicly because what are you going to get? You're just going to get scorn and ridicule. Well, that's what Jane Pooley got when she shared it publicly. But the benefit of her sharing it is that she's now contacted virtually on a weekly basis by women around the world who are saying, I've not told anybody this, but what you describe is exactly what happened to me. And the reason we don't know these stories is because we have a culture of ridicule around anything to do with ET company in the cosmos. And if we can't accept that, then we certainly can't accept an abduction story. But I know Jane. I consider her a very sane, reliable person. She's a registered nurse. She excelled herself on that interview, which was actually quite a difficult, hostile interview before they edited it down. And I applaud her for doing that because it's given permission to others to come forward with their stories. And I find very similarly from week to week, now I've published Escaping from Eden and the Scars of Eden, I'm contacted every week by people who've had anomalous experiences, including hybridization experiences, who don't go around boasting about these stories. They gain nothing from them. They don't get a better job or get paid more for a story like this or taken more seriously or given any more respect. So they tend not to tell people. And often people will be very cautious and they'll sound me out very carefully before saying, can I tell you something that happened to me? And on the basis of my experience, I think these stories are far more prevalent in the 21st century than you and I would ever imagine.
And I was interested to read that, is it Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who is a senior advisor to the Pope, was talking about how people reporting abduction experiences are having a totally different kind of contact and that they're not something demonic or it's not a psychotic episode.
Yes, that's right. Monsignor Corrado Balducci has been the Vatican's senior advisor in paranormal ministry. So if you're a Roman Catholic priest and you've got a parishioner saying, I've got a haunted house or I think there's a demon in my family, you've actually got the advantage of some people who specialize in that area who can advise you. And Monsignor Corrado Balducci is the top guy. So that's his background. And he came out in 2009 and he said, when people describe abduction experiences or close encounters, they are not reporting a psychotic break. It's not a psychiatric problem. It's not a demonic problem. And remember, those are all his areas of expertise. They are experiencing a totally different kind of entity, he said, one that merits serious study. And in the Roman Catholic world, when somebody of his seniority says that, and particularly when he said it in 2009, after the Pontifical Academy of Sciences had convened to discuss the theological implications of contact with other civilizations, well, you know he's got the papal imprimatur to go out and be saying these things. And it was part of a wave of papal representatives meeting the press in that period around 2009 to tell the public there is room in this cosmos for extraterrestrial civilizations. We shouldn't be surprised by contact. We should be ready to embrace cosmic neighbors as alien brothers and sisters. And we certainly shouldn't be surprised because they're mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and in the New Testament. And it was the senior astronomer for the Vatican Observatory, the Reverend Dr. Guy Consolmagno, who went the furthest and said, they're in the Bible, Old and New Testament, that really laid down the gauntlet for all people, not just Roman Catholics, but anyone who's paying attention, to go back to the Bible and realize there's a whole lot more going in there than you might have noticed. And it was throwing down the gauntlet to Christian theologians to say, you need to start accommodating what's in the Bible and what's in the cosmos. And again, from somebody of that seniority, you know that's being said with the approval of the Curia. And at that time, that was the time of Pope Benedict XVI, the most conservative pope in my lifetime. And so that really caught my attention. Why are they doing this? Why are so many papal representatives going to the press and saying we should be ready for contact and not go into a blind panic if we think it's happening? And I think it was because they thought some disclosure might be about to happen, that it might suddenly become blindingly obvious that we've got company. And they wanted to reassure the faithful that this was entirely possible and it didn't need to blow their Catholic faith out of the water. Why? Why were they making those announcements? It's intriguing all the more because the Royal Society held a very similar series of discussions, I think, the following year. And again, it was just a bit of a smoking gun that there are authorities, political authorities, religious authorities, who know a little bit more about the contact phenomenon than perhaps the general public do.
And you're reminding me of what you said about, is it Brigadier General Chaim Eshed, Chief of Israel's Military Space Security? You talked about off-world technology.
Yes, that's right. He was the Brigadier General who for 27 years was Israel's Chief of Space Security. And two Christmases ago, he came out, met the press, and he said, presumably on the basis of that 27 years of experience, that his understanding is that we are already in contact with ET civilizations at a covert government level, but that our neighbors have chosen not to self-disclose until human beings have a better understanding of what space is, and that these neighbors are so numerous that there's actually a body that he refers to as an intergalactic federation. Now, when he uses that language, he's using modern words for what's in the Bible as the Sky Council. And he's repeating what we heard for many, many years from Ed Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, who campaigned for the US government to come clean about being in contact with other spacefaring civilizations. So it's all the same story that they're repeating. Hamish Ed is a pretty authoritative figure to come out and state this. Now, what he's saying is ages old. Our ancestors told us the same thing thousands of years ago. But when someone in his position says it, I really think we ought to sit up and take notice.
Yeah, because it's not like he's retired now or he lost his job because he said it.
No, exactly. Exactly. There was nothing from Israel saying, we admire Brigadier General Hamish Ed, but we don't share his views. Nothing like that. Similarly, when Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev spoke on camera about contact, he said every new prime minister of Russia is given a folder detailing the civilizations we're already in contact with. Vladimir Putin didn't go to the press and say, he's a great prime minister, but I distance myself from those statements. He was only joking. You know, he'd had one too many vodkas or something like that. And similarly with other senior figures around the world, Alain Juillet, the former head of French intelligence, has spoken publicly saying that he was involved at the beginning of ATIP, which is the unit for investigating materials from UFO crashes. So when he said that, he was corroborating what we'd heard from Luis Elizondo, who headed up the Pentagon's investigation body for 10 years. He was supporting what we'd heard from Chris Mellon, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. They were all reaffirming each other's stories that there's been contact and that we're in possession of technology retrieved from UFO crashes. We've heard from senior, credible physicists like Eric W. Davis, who has briefed the Pentagon's body over a 10-year period, or the French physicist Jacques Vallée, who is involved in assessing and identifying these materials. Eric Davis is the one who used this really interesting phrase when he said that they were analyzing materials from off-world vehicles not made on this earth. Well, crumbs. Is there any other way that you could say UFO?
They didn't lose their jobs, but somebody who nearly did lose their job was...
Sorry, before you get on, you're going to John Mack, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. With these guys, yes, that's a really interesting comparison you're making there, Simon, because there's been a big shift. These people all made those statements. They were not censured for it. And they are all only one degree removed from being the person in authority making an official statement. Ladies and gentlemen, I have something I need to tell you. So you've got the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, the former Chief of French Intelligence, the former head of the Pentagon's UFO unit, the former Chief of Space Security for Israel, the former Minister of Defense for Canada, Paul Hellyer. So that's very, very close to an official statement. It is more or less an official statement. Whereas a generation ago, you go to the time of John Mack, who was really in the news in the 1990s, he was Harvard's head of clinical psychology. And he was tasked by US Defense to do psych evaluations on servicemen and women who were reporting close encounters, abduction experiences, and hybridization experiences. And what US Defense wanted to know is, are these people sane? Are they safe to fly? Or should we put them on a desk? That's really what they wanted to know. And so who better to do really authoritative psych evaluations than the head of clinical psychology for Harvard? And that was John Mack. So they went to him. He did 50 assessments. And his method was really interesting because he would put them into a state of deep relaxation, and then ask them to describe what they'd experienced. And then he would surprise them with supplementary questions like, sorry, just a minute, just turn your head to the left. Just tell me what you can see. Or then he'd interrupt again and say, tell me what you're feeling. What's touching you at the moment? And he correlated the answers that these servicemen and women gave to those supplementary questions, questions they had not prepared for in any way, and they all agreed with each other. And that's when he realized they had all experienced something objective that needed further investigation. And that was what he took back to US Defense. US Defense were happy to receive his report, but Harvard was horrified when they found out what was in his report. And they, as you were mentioning, Simon, tried to get rid of him, which they weren't legally entitled to do. And he had to get top legal defense in just to keep his job, and which he did. He kept his job, and Harvard had to put out a statement fully re-endorsing him. But John Mack, who was he was the top figure in his field. I mean, you can't get a more respectable scientist than John Mack, and a scholar, and a very gentle person, not a sensationalist in any way, but he was willing to go public with his findings and willing to take the scorn and ridicule that members of the public were willing to pour on him. Never mind, these members of the public knew a whole lot less about psychiatry than he did, a whole lot less about psychology, and a whole lot less about abduction experiences, since they hadn't been involved in any clinical research. But purely because he was acknowledging the possibility of extraterrestrials, members of the public felt free to publicly scorn and ridicule John Mack. And he was willing to take it because he was a scientist. And so I hold him in very high regard. He's a hero to a great many people for breaking the taboo in the 1990s. But the power of taboo is so strong. Every generation has to break the taboo, even to have these conversations.
It's been great talking to you. It's been fascinating. And the book is The Scars of Eden: Has Humanity Confused the Idea of God with Memories of ET Contact? And that's out on Amazon and everywhere, isn't it?
Anywhere that books are sold, Amazon, Kindle, Hive, Book Depository, Barnes & Noble, you should be able to find The Scars of Eden. And the prequel was Escaping from Eden, and the sequel is Echoes of Eden, which will be out later this year. But you can also, if you want to get into conversation with me, you can come to my website, which is paulanthonywallace.com, Anthony with an H, Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, paulanthonywallace.com. And you can also find me on the Paul Wallace channel on YouTube and the Fifth Kind TV on YouTube. I love being in conversation with people. I'm always there in the comments, having discussions. So if people would like to follow up with me, they can do any or all of those things.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
And that was an interview with Paul Wallace about his book, The Scars of Eden: Has Humanity Confused the Idea of God with Memories of ET Contact? And my book, which is titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, is available on Amazon. You can get it on audiobook, Kindle, or paperback. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.